At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Black Friday at BJ's Wholesale Club is so big, we called in the expert at paying less around the holidays.
Scrooge here. Past, present, or future, it's hard to beat the Black Friday deals at BJ's. Believe me, I've tried. Get 25% off select toys, 30% off select small appliances, and 45% off select TVs through December 1st. Plus, doorbuster deals Thanksgiving weekend. These prices are so good they even rattled old Marley's chain. Ah, humbug. Sorry, old habit.
Visit bjs.com/Black Friday for holiday savings.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
TRE in the afternoon, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good afternoon. You're now listening to Women Talk. With me in the studio today is Maeve Kelly, Katie Rowlands and Nikki Clements. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you all for coming in. If you are listening at home and you'd like to get involved, you can. Here's how.
To contact TRE, please call 952 78 4000. Email studio@tre.radio. Send us a WhatsApp on +34 645 99 67 95.
There is a trend for this year, 2025, and it's called underconsumption. I was chatting with the guys on Men Talk about this last week and thought I'd save it to see if you had anything to add to it. The idea of kind of spending less, being more choosy about what you're spending your money on, use reusable goods when you can, maybe, you know, dig into your clothes closet and realise what clothes you've already got that you might haven't worn for a while, as opposed to buying new stuff, finding free, fun things to do with your friends or your kids or whatever, all this kind of stuff, which I thought was really interesting and something I'm happy to get on board with. Is it something you think about or have thought about going into a new year?
It's something I've been reflecting on because there's a person on TikTok called Bradley on a Budget, and he takes this to the absolute extreme.
Okay.
He's only got two towels in his apartment. He's got an old dorm bed and he spends so little money. He even sort of steals toilet paper from restaurants and cafes and takes it back home.
Wow.
But the reason why I follow him is because he's more of a real extreme case and I find him quite intriguing, but he actually admits it's kind of a bit of a trauma response. So I think all of these things are on a bit of a spectrum. I think if you're going as far to the one end as Bradley on a Budget, it's probably a little bit extreme for the average person.
Yeah, he's probably quite obsessive about
exactly,
it.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. But I mean, I like the idea of, because we're always, I feel like we're always kind of programmed to spend more money. We're encouraged by people that we're looking at online that we need to be spending more to look good, to feel good, all this kind of thing. Everything costs money. So I like the idea that it's trendy to spend less.
Yes. So I'm a big fan of apps and things like Vinted to repurpose, to buy secondhand, to sell things on. I'm a big fan of decluttering and I like my space, you know, getting rid of things that aren't being used. I think it is quite fairly therapeutic, but obviously some people do really struggle to let go of things. But I do like sort of clearing the way a little bit. Selling things on and buying things secondhand, it's definitely a shift from when I was younger, when it's almost it's more important that things were new, whereas now I quite like the fact that they've been used before, or even my son has clothes that he loves if he knows where they've come from. So even if it's friends passing them on, he's sort of, that's quite something that he's quite fond of. So which is nice.
Yeah, definitely. It's nice to get the kids excited about it from when they're young, because it can be easy to, you know, as they grow up, think, why do I want to wear someone else's stuff?
Yeah, there's not so much of a stigma, you know. It's sort of, it's a positive thing.
Yeah, nice.
I also think in lots of ways you can be less materialistic and have less of a need to spend money in Spain, because we can do lots of things for free in Spain.
Yeah, we can go to the outdoor beach. Life, it's easier, isn't it?
It's almost like if you breathe in the UK, you have to take a mortgage out. If you go out for a coffee, you've already spent £4.60 I spent over Christmas on a coffee in Wales. And I just thought, wow, that's really expensive.
Yeah.
I'd get that for £1.70 in Spain. So yeah. We're very lucky here that life's a lot more affordable, and actually for entertainment purposes there's lots of free events on and things like that. But I also think this idea of being frugal does also depend on your sort of your where you are in life. So I suppose it depends on how much disposable income you have, or whether you have lots of income. It depends on how much you're earning at that point in your life.
It can depend on your friends as well. You know, I've gone through various stages in life where friends have got a lot more money than I have, or vice versa, and that can be quite tricky. You know, when you need to say, I'm really, you know, I'd love to go to this restaurant with you for your birthday, but you know, we can't afford it at the moment, or it's a bit more than we can spend, or whatever. And you know, sometimes you just have to be honest, instead of feeling, oh, can't say no to this. You know, you have to be honest in the situation that you're in, don't you? Because you're not always going to have the same amount of money as your friends.
And sometimes, in some instances, spending more money can help you save money. So if you spend more on a food shop, that's going to probably help you save money in going out for food. So sometimes you've got to push yourself to say, oh, actually, let's get a few more treats here so I'm not splurging during the week. So.
Yeah. I was amazed when I saw this article to see that it's a trend, because bizarrely, completely coincidental, it was a big conversation that my husband and I had at the start of the year, you know, when you kind of reflect back on the previous year and think, oh, what can we do differently and what do we want to achieve and do this year? And one of the things was being more conscious about what we're spending our money on. And, you know, not just willy-nilly, you know, spending for the sake of spending. And we as part of the decluttering thing that we also did, going through the kitchen and going through the cupboards and all this kind of stuff and throwing things away that were out of date, realizing how many different types of rice and pasta and pulses that we had in our house.
Wow.
But yet, you know, we'd finish a type of pasta shape that we particularly liked, and then I'd go out and buy more without kind of being aware that we had seven other types of pasta but in the cupboard that we could easily...
Your household's big into cooking, aren't you? So you need that seven types of pasta, of course.
Well, yes and no. We're trying to be good now. We've just done it for the last 2 weeks. We're only into the first couple of weeks of the year, and we've been really good with the shopping. We've worked out, you know, when we're going out, when we're staying in, and when we are staying in, what we're going to eat, you know, with the stuff we already have in the house, what we need to buy to add to what we've already got, as opposed to buying a whole new meal. And it's made a huge difference just in these last 2 weeks. We've spent a lot less on food shopping, a lot less, because we've been more aware of what we've already got and just bought a few things.
And tried more varieties of pasta.
Yeah, exactly. It's true. And making a meal that you can make last a few days, that's really good. Like making a vegetable curry, for example, and then the next day adding some meat maybe, or the next day having it with rice, the next day having it with chopping some potatoes and adding, you know, just kind of changing it each day, making it last. It's really good.
I was also inspired by one of my frugal colleagues, because she puts all her money into virtual and physical pots. So she'll have an envelope for leisure, an envelope for groceries, and then she'll have a pot on her phone for makeup. And I just thought it was fascinating how lots of people manage their money in a different way.
Yeah.
So you can learn a lot from the people around you.
Definitely. Yeah, it's a great conversation. You know, ask people how they, or if they save money, and the different ways that they do it. Yeah, interesting. Okay, this is one about food. For generations, children have been told to clear their plates before leaving the table. Now, experts suggest that this may be fueling the obesity crisis by encouraging youngsters to overeat. In a survey, 37% of parents said they always or often make their children eat everything in front of them, and 48% let their children have second helpings at least once a week. One in 10 parents with children aged between 5 and 11 give them the same size portions as themselves, which is really interesting. I just kind of looked at that and thought, well, make the portions smaller. I mean, that just seems like an obvious kind of thing. I don't know. I mean, if you're telling your children they don't need to finish what they're eating, then it's sort of encouraging waste, I would have thought.
Yeah, and as a parent, I think there's nothing I like more than seeing my children eat. You know, there's a sort of satisfaction that you get from that.
Yeah.
But I think also, you know, it's important just for generally for them to be healthy and to teach being healthy rather than having to eat everything on your plate. It doesn't specify what's on that plate.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's possibly not the best thing to do to sort of push them to finish everything on their plate, but... But like you say, you have to consider what's being put on that plate, how big a portion size it is. Things like seconds, again, I think it just depends how that child's diet is or how children's, you know, what they eat as to what's appropriate and not. I've grew up always being told to eat the most expensive thing if I was full. So. Yes. As long as you eat the expensive bit, then that's fine. I'm not sure what kind of that is. But
I just remember as a child the idea that you weren't allowed to have dessert unless you finished your main course. Mm. Because it was like, well, if you're not hungry enough to eat your main course, you clearly don't have room for dessert, which always kind of made sense to me. You know, you can't... I don't think it's... You know, unless the child really doesn't like it or whatever, I don't know. But I think, you know, if your child just picks at their main course and then quite happily will sit there and have apple crumble and custard, it's like, well, that doesn't really...
Yeah, you could suggest that the sort of processed foods are fueling the obesity crisis more than children just being told to eat what's on their plate.
That's true.
But, yeah.
I remember, well, I don't remember because I was only little, but a story that my mum always used to tell me when I was really, really little, sitting at the table and I had food in my mouth. And I started to talk and my mum said, "No, Hannah, finish what's in your mouth before you talk." And I looked really uncomfortable and did a bit more chewing and then started to talk again. "No, Hannah, you need to finish what's in your mouth before you talk." I tried it a few times and then, you know, looking really, really pained and then eventually... swallowed it and she said, "Okay, you can talk. What did you want to say?" And I said, "I don't like it. Can I spit it out?" I thought that's really funny. She made me eat it. She felt so bad. She said, "Oh, you're so good for eating. I'm so sorry." Oh, dear. Makes me laugh. We better take a break.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Women Talk. With me in the studio today is Maeve Kelly, Katie Rowlands and Nikki Clements. There's an article about drinking tea or the tea break. If the thought of a tea break is the only thing getting you through the working day, you might soon be left high and dry. For the tradition appears to be dying out, with almost half of Britons now saying they don't share a regular brew with colleagues. 5 years ago, the average worker had at least one tea break a day, but two-thirds say they have noticed a fall in the custom.
I love a cup of tea.
Yeah?
Yes, but I don't think we have active cup of tea breaks. We normally just bring in a flask or we go to the cafe and buy something from work. I think the thing is, since COVID, the idea of working 9 till 5 has been changed around, which means people have much more flexible days. So sometimes people want to just get through their day, get through their tasks, so they can get home quicker, so they can have that cup of tea or glass of wine at home.
Definitely.
Rather than faffing about and work.
Yeah.
Because I think the older generation's idea of working was sort of to be seen to be working, but actually you can get the work done in a much shorter amount of time just as efficiently as someone faffing around and having one cigarette break and two tea breaks, for example.
I totally agree. I was interviewing someone the other day talking about work and the hours spent at work, and I know how long it takes me to do what I need to do, and I will come in for that amount of time and just kind of get on with it.
Yes.
And if I'm distracted or if I sat there and had a break for ages, I wouldn't finish what I needed to do.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So I do when I come to work, I'm completely in work mode and I just get on with it. And very often I finish what I needed to do like 2 minutes before my show starts, and I'm like, "Ha, done everything. Great."
Real pro you are.
But, you know, if I sat there for 20 minutes having a break or having a chat for ages, I'd be behind what I needed to do. If I was here for the whole day, then for sure I'd
I'd take breaks because I'd, you know, have loads of extra time. Mm. But I think it depends, doesn't it, on your hours and stuff.
Yeah, and you can feel guilty then if you can see everyone else is working, or you're thinking,
yes,
I should, in the back of your mind, you think, I should be doing that, I should be doing that, not sitting down with my cup of tea.
Yeah.
But it is nice to take a break as well. Yeah. You need a break.
Yeah, it's true. It totally depends. Depends on the work, it depends on the job, depends on the environment. Mm. I just remember years ago, the idea of having a break with your colleagues was a nice thing to do. You know, you'd go and, depending on where you were, sit in an area where the coffee machine was, or maybe you'd sit outside on a patio where the people were smoking or whatever, and you'd take a break together, and it would be a really nice thing to do. Mm. And
I think there seems to be a shift as well. So when you do want to take a break, it's more commonly now that people take that to have that time to themselves, or have that time with their phone, or catch up on personal things, or just sort of lose themselves, you know, to almost be away from other people for that break. So it's a break from, you know, from being people, from absolutely, from people.
Yeah.
Which sort of takes away, even if you sit with a cup of tea and do that, it's still not particularly sociable now. It doesn't sit that group kind of sort of community of opportunity seems to be lost now.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think it has changed. Okay. Young adults are hiring others or relying on parents to do basic DIY, such as changing a light bulb or cleaning the car. Halfords says its survey of 2,000 adults showed that those aged 18 to 27 were most likely to pay a professional for straightforward household tasks, and suggested the younger generation are go-dits, which stands for get others to do it. Not heard that before. 1 in 5 did not know what a spanner was, and nearly a quarter could not change a ceiling light bulb, with many saying ladders are too dangerous. Well, this is interesting. I always think with this that, you know, it gives youngsters a bad rap, as if, you know, why aren't youngsters doing this? But most people, I would assume, learn about DIY from their parents.
Mm.
So if youngsters don't know how to change a plug or a light bulb, it's potentially because their parents didn't show them how to.
Mm.
Yeah,
so I blame the parents.
I've started reading a book called The Anxious Generation, and it's about people who are roughly 27 and below. So I think the survey said 18 to 27. And it's about how that generation have grown up with screens throughout sort of their childhood, whereas I'm a little bit older than that, 31. And I've seen this a little bit in the classroom over the years, and it's called learned helplessness. I think a lot of things to that generation and younger become increasingly easy. So, for example, when I used to want to listen to music back in the day, I'd have to rip the music onto a CD and then put it into my car. But these days you can get everything instantaneously.
Mm.
So I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that some things in life are so easy these days that if you're trying to learn a new skill, you have to battle through all those stages to get to the final product. And I think it's not as instantaneous as going on Google or going on AI and finding the answer. So
people want ease.
I think some of that motivation needs to be learned by the young adult, and also it needs to be encouraged by the parents bringing them up, perhaps, I don't know, to have a little bit more screen free time and learn some more of those skills.
Yeah,
but I remember trying to do some basic skills when I first lived on my own in Spain, and I struggled with some of those things, and I would ring up my dad crying and I'd say, I don't know how to change a bike tyre. And it took a couple of years for me to sort of get to understand these basic things, but it was a bit of a battle because I think I was just used to my parents doing quite a lot for me as well.
Exactly. And we can be, and that can absolutely go throughout life.
Yes.
It really can. You know, if you need to do something like change a light bulb, or a bike tire or whatever, you have a choice. If you have someone in your life, whether it's a partner, a sibling, a parent or whatever, that's easy, that you know knows how to do it, it's very easy to call them and either ask them to do it for you or ask them for help, or go onto YouTube. How do you change a bike tire? I mean, it's all there, isn't it?
And I think that's it. Until there's a need to know, then there's not very much interest in actually kind of learning these skills, you know, even down to things like ironing, you know, as a for young adults, you know, if they don't mind their clothes not being ironed, then they've got no interest in ironing their clothes. So it's only when they want it done, or they, you know, they need it done, and then they have to step up. I think then there's the interest and the googling and the, but like you say, it's all there for them to watch and to get be instructed on. So you know, maybe that's the parents could give them some input, but I think as much you said about the immediacy for parents as well, it's quicker to do it yourself than to show your children, even though that might not be the right thing. I think you know, it applies for parents as well.
But. Definitely.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? I think, I mean, I'm sure it must have been more normal decades ago because you couldn't Google it, because it wasn't on YouTube. I just think people had to learn these skills much more. And I guess in general, you know, going back generations, people maybe had a bit less disposable income. So the idea of calling up a handyman and getting them to change a light bulb would have been seen as a, you know, a ridiculous waste of money. Just do it yourself. It's easy to do it yourself. You don't, you know, it's not dangerous if you know what you're doing. So there was always kind of...
People always knew how to check the oil in the car and things like that.
Exactly.
You know, now it's... not so much.
I only got good at doing those kind of things when we went through quarantine, and I was about 25, 26, because we couldn't hire anyone to help us and we couldn't even go outside. So those sort of things I did learn because I had to, because I didn't have those access to people so easily and things like that. So I think you're absolutely right about the need of having to do something.
It's like, I'll only learn if I have to learn.
It's true. Okay, this is on a similar-ish subject. Baffled by your washing machine, in a tangle over the tumble dryer settings, left cold by the oven timer. Then you're not alone. The struggles of millions of technology-challenged Britons have with our home appliances have been laid bare in a poll. It found that 4 in 10 of us always stick to the same washing settings because we're scared of using the wrong one. 28% consider the washing machine the most confusing piece of household tech. I can relate to this, to be honest.
I was baffled by that.
Oh, were you?
Oh, no. Yes. I use the same thing
I use the same one all the time.
And I had to Google what picture it's flashing at me and everything. What does that picture mean?
So do you use all the different settings on your washing machine depending what you're putting in? You know what it all does?
Yes, I think so, because...
Oh, very impressive. You'll have to teach us.
there's two major icons, isn't there? There's one's to do with a spin normally and one's to do with the temperature. And if it's just spinning, it's just drying. And then if it's...
We're all taking notes.
And if it's temperature and spinning, it's a wash and then a dry. Surely it's not that complicated. I actually make it even more complicated for myself by putting it on a smart plug. So I make it more challenging by starting off the washing machine in the evening. And then I say to the Alexa, Alexa, turn off the washing machine once I've already started on the cycle. And then
Alexa turns off your washing machine.
Yes. I've got smart plugs.
She is clever.
I know. But sometimes I name it the fan. So if I'm having a particularly wild day, I'll say, Alexa, turn off the fan. But I know it's the washing machine plug, if that makes sense. And then I'll say,
all the fun you have in your house.
And then I'll say, Alexa, could you please turn on the washing machine at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, please? And then the switch will go back on for 6 a.m. and then my clothes will be ready to put out before I go to work.
That is clever. I wonder how many Alexas were listening just then and are now setting their washing machines to 6 a.m. I've never even heard of that you can get so what's it called, a smart plug?
They're called one of the brands called Tapo plugs, and they're smart plugs, and you can connect them with the Alexas. I think I've got 4 in my house. So I've got
For different pieces of equipment.
So I've got one for the heater upstairs, one for the heater downstairs, one which I change around between my electric bike and the washing machine, and then I've got 2 smart bulbs.
This is fascinating. Is this a new world to you too as well? Or are you
I've never used them. I was aware of them, but not ever.
But the problem is, if, for example, your electricity or your internet goes down, the bulbs stop working completely. So
they're not that smart then.
No.
If your internet goes, then your whole house falls apart.
And one of my colleagues said he was staying in a house and the lights turned on automatically during the night and he didn't know how to verbally turn it off. So there are some flaws to the system. So I'd know I don't find a basic washing machine complicated, basically.
Wow. Well, you've made me feel less smart in all kinds of ways. That's amazing. Yeah, what about the oven?
I'm not too bad with my oven.
No.
Although when the power goes off and it resets the
yes,
clock.
Yes, who knows?
I can never work out how to reset the clock.
No, same.
So it just stays wrong.
Our oven clock is never right. Yeah.
I think the oven's quite straightforward. The only thing that frustrates me...
You've got a smart one, have you?
No. The only thing that frustrates me is that it takes longer to heat up than the average one.
Okay.
So if my mum visits me, she'll say, oh, it takes a long time to heat up this oven, doesn't it? Right. So I said, yes, it does.
Do it a lot, yeah.
Just need to wait a bit longer.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Riveting.
Yeah, it is. I'm gonna go onto YouTube and I'm gonna look up all the different settings so I know what my washing machine can do for me. Exciting times. We better take a break.
Hannah Murray, TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Women Talk with me in the studio today, Maeve Kelly, Katie Rowlands and Nikki Clements. Just had a message from Jane who says, hi, Hannah, restaurants work like this nowadays. All commands are for Alexa. Switch off the oven in 20 minutes, switch on the oven in an hour, etc., etc. It's amazing. Wow, there you go. I'm impressed. This one... I thought it was quite controversial, but this annoyed me slightly, so I'm interested to hear your thoughts. It says smokers are more likely to give up the habit and stay off it if given rewards. The incentives are particularly effective with pregnant women who are twice as likely to quit when offered financial rewards. Health campaigners said the clear evidence should lead to the widespread delivery of reward schemes for pregnant smokers, which could involve cash payments, vouchers, or the return of a deposit paid by those taking part. Now, I get that obviously smoking is addictive, you know, and it can be very difficult to stop smoking, especially, you know, if someone's telling you you need to stop smoking, it's got to be something that you want to do. I would have thought if you're pregnant, the incentive should be to make sure your baby's okay.
Yeah.
I feel like if someone's more persuaded by getting an Amazon voucher than they are for the health of their baby, that's kind of worrying and odd.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. It's
slightly concerning. You know what I mean? Like, surely the incentive is, now I'm pregnant, if I stop smoking, my baby's more likely to be, wow.
It is quite shocking.
So it is really shocking. Really
shocking.
Sort
of wonder what the statistics are with it, you know, and just how many people they've been looking at to work this out. So how many pregnant women are there out there who need to be given a prize for stopping smoking?
I know. And where's the money coming from as well? That's also a bit... I don't quite understand that. It doesn't make sense to me. The incentive should be pretty obvious. Yeah. You'd think that health of yourself and your baby is the incentive, really, isn't it, with giving up smoking as opposed to money. If you can give up smoking because someone's offering you money...
Then you should be able
then
to
you
give
should
up
be
smoking.
Able to give up smoking anyway. Like, yeah, odd one. Mm. Okay, anyone who has watched Sex and the City will know that friends Carrie, Samantha, Charlotte and Miranda couldn't be more different. Now, a study shows opposites really do attract. For women, men, however, are more likely to find company in those who think like them. This particular survey found that men prefer friends who behave similarly. Women, meanwhile, were more likely to choose friends with other perspectives. While men often bond over shared activities, women usually focus more on emotional support and diverse opinions. I thought that was an interesting one. Thoughts when you think about your own friends? Are your own friends really similar to you or quite different? And why?
I suppose I've got quite a lot of diverse friends, different ages, they're from different countries. And I don't really look into whether they're similar or not, but I suppose you've got to have something shared, whether that's going out for a coffee or going on a bike. Otherwise, for me, I suppose activities are quite important, but the emotional part is also essential as well. So
yeah,
but you think you have friends for different parts of your life, and sometimes you have a friend forever, or it's just a season of your life, or they're there to give you a lesson of some sort. So I think it depends really on the situation.
I like the fact that being an expat, I feel like it's much more normal to have different kinds of friends that are different ages and from different countries and different backgrounds. And you know, when I think of a lot of friends in the UK, they only hang around generally with people their own age, from the same kind of background, may have all gone to school together, all gone to college together, their kids are all friends. And I think that's lovely. I really think there's a really, really lovely side to that, all growing up together and stuff. I think that's great. But one of the things that I love about here is that I do have friends who are 20 years younger than me and 30 years older than me, and it's totally normal. Exactly. And I love that.
I think for women especially, it's sort of almost more important that your friends get you as such, rather than having things in common or you know, having the same beliefs and things like that. It's feeling understood by your friends, no matter what their age or where they live, or you know, whether you see them every day or they're just, you know, friends from her home back in the UK. I think that's the key thing that sort of makes your friendships important. I'm not sure, maybe that is different for men, where it needs to be a bit more sort of, have sort of similar things in common. And but I think it's that emotional sort of support and connection that creates the sort of strength in relationships and friendships for women.
I think you kind of see the difference, like what you were saying, Katie, about having different friends for kind of different reasons and different lengths of time. And you know, there were friends that I would do some things with, and you know, more kind of exercise things with, others that I'd more go for a long lunch with, and you know, different things like that. And it can be quite normal to discuss different topics with different types of friends. You know, if you have got friends who are totally on the same page as you with so many different things, you know, your belief system, your morals, what you think about politically, all that kind of thing, then sometimes it's nice to talk about those controversial subjects when you're both on the same page, because you're like, and the way that this happens and the guy on the telly was saying that, and you're having a really passionate discussion, and you're both coming from the same place. But having those kind of discussions with people who have the opposite view, I don't like kind of getting into an argument with friends, you know. And there are certain subjects, when they say don't talk about religion and politics, that I think if you know that a good friend of yours has the opposite point of view, I think it's okay that there can be subjects that you just don't talk about. There's just no need to kind of go there, because you're great friends despite the fact that you have opposite political views or religious views. So
I also think it's important to be around different types of people, because they say you become the average of the 3 to 5 people you spend most of your time with.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, so if I go and think about, for example, my colleagues, and I probably work with between 100 to 150 people, I have lots of different groups.
That's amazing.
I know. So I can choose who I'm going to go and sit with at lunchtime. And I think I've got some Spanish friends, and they will really encourage me to speak Spanish and sort of introduce me to Spanish culture. I've got my dad gang, who I go out on bike rides with, and I'm often the only female there, so I got to sort of get that banter. And I have other sort of different groups in my work environment, which is really lovely. And you learn so much from different people, and also people who are nearing retirement as well. And they sort of give you the wisdom of life, and they're their biggest life lessons and things like that.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I think it's really important to spend time with people younger than you. And you can learn an awful lot from people younger than you, often about things that maybe you might not understand so much, like washing machines or AI or technology or whatever. And absolutely. Absolutely. Learn a lot from older people. And, you know, it can be, definitely. I think that's one of the best things about living here, being able to have great relationships with totally different types of
people. It's very exciting seeing all these different types of people all the time.
Yeah,
I think sometimes when I go back to the UK, I just think sometimes the group of people I'm around are quite homogenous, and they're sort of, they've been in the same town and same interests, same ages. If you're with a friend from South Africa or a friend from Australia, you think, what are they going to come out with next? Because they've had a completely different upbringing to yourself.
Definitely. And it's fascinating. It's great if you can, I mean, maybe it's the interviewer in me, but I find it interesting to ask people about their background and their childhood and the countries that they visited and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's, that's what life's about, isn't it, I think. It's for me anyway. We better take the last break.
TRE.radio. Hannah Murray. TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the last part of today's Women Talk with Maeve Kelly, Katie Rowlands and Nikki Clements. This headline reads, "My sister wants to use my wedding as a gender reveal party." A woman is conflicted after her pregnant sister kicked off when she refused to allow her to use her wedding for her gender reveal party. Gender reveal parties, for anyone listening that doesn't really know what they are, they've kind of ramped up in popularity in recent years. Basically, parents-to-be going to extreme lengths to concoct elaborate or particularly creative methods to share whether they're having a boy or a girl. So like a balloon might be popped and loads of pink stuff comes out, or blue stuff, that kind of stuff. So things took a turn recently when at a family dinner, she casually explained she'd love to have her gender reveal take part during the woman's wedding reception when everyone is already gathered and spirits are high. She even had a plan ready. Halfway through the reception, she'd cut the cake and boom, it's either pink or blue inside. She seemed genuinely excited, but I was a bit taken aback. I told her I'd think about it, but honestly, I wasn't thrilled. I mean, it's my wedding day. I want it to be about me and my fiancé, not about a baby we didn't make. What do we think?
I can't imagine having your own cake at someone else's wedding.
No,
it's like, exactly. I'm just going to bring my own cake and make it all about me, even it's though bizarre. It's not my wedding.
Yeah.
Yeah, I... No, you can't make something all about you at someone else's wedding.
No, I agree. It's not good, is it?
Yeah, the desire to kind of take the spotlight away from the person whose sort of day it is. It's,
yeah.
It makes me think about the mother of the bride who wears a white dress, or
yes,
someone who
exactly.
wears like a wedding dress to the wedding. It just seems a bit unpleasant. It's not the nicest thing.
Exactly, it's not. And you should want, when you do a gender reveal party, you should want that to be all about you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You should want the two things to be separate. The wedding is about the wedding couple. The gender reveal party would all be about you and your partner, and you know, I don't see why the two should be combined.
The issue is that she does want to make it all about her, even though it's not her wedding.
Yeah. Difficult. Tricky with the sisters and what to say, and I mean, yeah, the sister shouldn't have suggested it, should she? So now the other one's got to say, I'm sorry, no, but that's not okay. Okay, Valentine's Day is coming up. There's an article about this particular Valentine's card, which I wanted to ask you about. But before we do that, I just wanted to ask you what you thought about Valentine's Day card. Does it make a difference whether you're in a relationship, whether you're single? Do you send them if you're in a relationship or single? Do you expect one if you're in a relationship? How do you feel about Valentine's Day?
I'm not a big fan. I kind of think it's a bit silly. It just seems to be a fabricated day to make somebody do something nice. Or I'd rather just, you know, to have nice things done for me any day.
Yeah.
not have to hold out for that one day to get some flowers or a card. So, yeah, I'm not a massive fan of Valentine's Day.
It's not something you'd celebrate, though.
Not really, no. No.
I somewhat agree, because I think it's quite a commercial thing, isn't it?
For
the companies to make lots of money, and you should be able to celebrate your loved person any day.
Oh, yeah. It's just whether people do. That's the thing.
That's a good point.
Do people get flowers throughout the year and appreciated and that sort of thing?
I'm not a massive fan of enforced celebration. We should be celebrating when we feel like it.
All the time. Flowers every day. Well, I have to be honest, my husband and I do, and we like it. We don't do Christmas cards for each other. Some couples buy each other Christmas cards. We don't do that. But we do get each other a Valentine's Day card every year, and normally get each other a present, and normally do a nice kind of dinner either at home or go out somewhere. And I quite like the excuse to do it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I don't mind it at all. I think it's nice to kind of, celebrate each other.
Maybe it's because I'm normally single around Valentine's Day. And the best Valentine's present I ever received was when I was 12. So... I think he'd written a poem by hand and typed it up on Microsoft Word and then put a heart border and then given me a necklace with my initial on. Wow. And then...
At 12?
Yes.
Oh, my
He was keen.
And we weren't even dating. And then he put like a heart-shaped chocolate in a little tin.
That That's yeah. So no, no other man will ever live up to this 12-year-old boy.
And I wasn't going out with him, and I never did go out with him. So I think that's the probably pinnacle of my Valentine's days.
Yeah. You peaked too soon.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. I remember I didn't, I never used to, I remember when I was at school feeling quite traumatised because so many girls would get Valentine's Day cards and I hardly ever did.
I don't think I did, ever did. I think maybe that's where my disinterest in Valentine's Day comes from. It's like a defence mechanism.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't support it, therefore I don't need any cards.
Fair enough. I was like, how come everyone else is getting... And like you say, these grand kind of displays of love.
I only had it once.
Yeah, very.
It was just very grand from a 12-year-old boy.
Definitely.
Mm. I was 12 as well.
I wonder if his parents knew.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Have to ask him.
Oh, you still have him?
Well, only on Facebook. I'm not sure I can ask him that message on Facebook
that
after
really
19
funny.
Years. That would be a bit odd.
Oh, I love it. So they're talking about in this article a card for a work husband. The concept has been seen risky by many, with some suggesting that sending such a card is simply asking for trouble. One woman said, if someone gave this card to my husband, I would be going to jail. I would be deeply unhappy to receive or learn that my partner has received a Valentine's Day card from their work spouse. The whole concept is odd.
Mm. I think you can appreciate your work colleagues, but I don't know if sending a card on Valentine's Day, that's a little bit too far, isn't it?
It does seem a bit
strange. It's supposed to be romantic and about love. Why are you thinking about this person when you're buying the card?
Yeah.
Maybe alarm bells might ring.
Yeah,
exactly. Why are you thinking about this person?
Unless you're both single, and that's probably fair game.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I was thinking, I wonder if it depends on the job. You know, if you're in an office job and you work with loads of people, to kind of refer to each other as that might be a bit strange. But I've seen two people who host radio shows, for example, together for many, many years. You know, might host a breakfast show together for years and years and years. And I've seen, you know, on social media, them refer to each other as their work husband and their work wife. You know, they've obviously got a great relationship. They're working just the two of them together on a daily basis for years on end. So I think in that concept, that sort of makes sense.
Yeah, the term makes sense, but the giving a card on Valentine's Day seems a little bit...
I agree. True. I think the term's fine. I think sometimes you spend more time in the workplace with your work colleagues and they probably do a lot for you sometimes. Mm. But like you said, the timing's not great, is it?
No. Yes, okay, I see what you mean. The to say it is one thing, but to actually buy a card, to market with that. That makes sense. Okay, we've got under 5 minutes left. The proportion of young couples getting married has dropped by almost a third since the 1960s amid a deeply troubling fall off in matrimony. Trends indicate that fewer than 6 in 10 of those born between 1997 and 2012 will ever tie the knot. Thoughts on marriage?
I think people are put off by the complications of divorce, really. I think the idea of marriage is still something that you know, is quite appealing to lots of people, but the impact of separation, what comes with that, financial stress, emotional stress, children, legal system, courts and everything. I just think that I think for lots of people it's almost too much to, you know, it's off-putting. So you know, you can live quite happily without being married. Mm. I think that's possibly why it's, you know, one of the reasons why it's sort of fallen out of favour or, you know, isn't being taken up quite so much.
And before it was like a milestone that you had to reach, especially for women, you were expected to get married, where now there isn't as much pressure on women to get married. You can have your career, you can do what you want. So it could be part of that as well, that people are just enjoying independence, or they just don't see it as something they have to do anymore.
Yeah. I remember always thinking I wanted to, you know, I'd always kind of thought that I would, like to, I never felt I had to, but just kind of thought, I like the idea of, of having a wedding and being someone's wife, you know, just the whole concept of it. I've always kind of thought, yes, I would like that for me, personally speaking.
Or perhaps some people are delaying it because of the pressure to have a fantastic wedding. I suppose weddings in the UK probably cost quite a lot of money these days, don't they?
Yeah. Well, yeah, not just in the UK. Yeah, it depends what you want to do. But they can cost a ridiculous amount of money.
And it's like keeping up with the Joneses. You might want to appear like you're having an amazing wedding, but maybe you can't quite front the cost of that wedding, so you might as well wait until you're both in a financially stable position, especially if you're living somewhere like London or something like that, where it's a high cost of living, and probably to have a wedding in London's probably astronomical.
And just the word wedding on top of anything, wedding cake, wedding hair, wedding dress, you know, all these kind of things that cost a certain amount, add the word wedding and you can add a couple of noughts on. I mean, it's quite frightening how much things can cost. I remember the first quote I got for a wedding cake. I was like, what? But we're going to eat it. It's not like, I couldn't believe it. I literally couldn't believe it. Yes. Okay. We've got under 2 minutes. Oh, this is on the same kind of subject. My secret £200,000 marriage escape fund and why every woman should have one. This is the idea of having a kind of secret bank account that your husband doesn't know about in case anything goes wrong, and then you're financially all right on your own.
I'd love to know how they saved £200,000.
Yes, quite.
Where they got the money from. Step-by-step instructions first.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I find it odd keeping something like that secret from my husband. I'd find that really weird.
Yeah, I think unless there's a doubt over the fairness of, you know, of events should they go wrong, I guess you sort of feel like it shouldn't be necessary.
No, exactly.
And if you feel like it is necessary, perhaps there's your cue that, you know, you should
there's your
be
red
there.
Flag. Yes, exactly. Anyone else? No. Okay. We have under a minute left, so there's no need to kind of crack on with another subject. So we'll leave it there. Maeve Kelly, Katie Rowlands and Nikki Clements, thank you all very much
for being with us today.
Have a great weekend. If you're listening at home, Howard Brereton is coming up next with Spain Today. And as I said earlier, it is Thursday, which means it's the book show. So tonight from 7 till 9 is the book show with some really fascinating authors that I've spoken to in the last week or so. And all the books, as always, are available on our website, tre.radio, where you can hear any of the shows on catch up, on the 7-day catch up. Have a good weekend. Bye bye.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.